The price of oil surges. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor in for David Brancaccio. Brent crude oil hit $112 a barrel this morning, highest level in 8 years. West Texas Intermediate hit its highest level in 11 years. The driver here, of course, is the fear of disruptions to global supply of energy from Russia's war on Ukraine. The oil cartel OPEC and its allies, which include Russia, decided today they are not going to dramatically increase global supply, so no relief there. Let's bring in Susan Schmidt, head of U.S. equities with Aviva Investors. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
How long do you think until the price of oil that we're seeing surging translates into what people see at the pump?
I think it's already translating into what people see at the pump. This shortage isn't going to be resolved anytime soon. And as long as that Russia-Ukraine conflict goes on, the market is going to continue to be nervous about oil and drive that price up.
We got ADP employment numbers for February. That's the number of people on private payrolls, increased by 475,000 in February. That's a pretty good number. What is that telling us about the U.S. economy, Ukraine, Russia aside?
We want to see that type of increase going forward. It means people are coming back to work. Ideally, it means that more people are getting back into the workforce in those supply chain lines as well.
With all that in the background, we've got Fed Chair Jerome Powell testifying before the House today. It'll be the first time we've heard from him since the Ukraine war started. Has the Fed's thinking changed on when and how much they will raise interest rates?
The market certainly expects their handling of interest rate increases to change because of the global conflict. And the market has gone from 6-7 increases that were expected in the interest rates this year down to just 2 or 3.
Susan Schmidt, head of U.S. equities with Aviva Investors. BP, General Motors, Apple, Exxon, Boeing. These are some of the companies putting their Russia operations on hold or pulling out of that country entirely. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
Apple has stopped selling its products in Russia, including iPhones, and it's restricting Apple Pay and other services in its ecosystem. ExxonMobil is pulling out of a joint venture in Russia and says it will not invest in new developments there. The move follows in the footsteps of BP and Shell, which have already made similar announcements. Ford is part of a joint venture in Russia as well. It's suspending those operations, which involve commercial van manufacturing. That's also in the footsteps of others in its sector. GM, Harley-Davidson, Honda, and others have stopped shipping products to Russia. And Airbus and Boeing have stopped supporting the maintenance of their aircraft operated by Russian companies. That further isolates Russia's aviation sector, which is contending with canceled airplane leases and bans from European and Canadian airspace. Yesterday, in his State of the Union address, President Biden said Russian planes will be barred from U.S. airspace as well. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Increasingly, many renters in the U.S. are finding out that their landlord is, in fact, an investment firm or backed by one. This is a trend that's accelerated recently. Now, what makes these landlords different? Well, according to an investigation from the nonprofit news outlet ProPublica, some of them invest for the short term and ignore the long-term maintenance and quality of life concerns that other landlords might pay more attention to. ProPublica's Heather Vogel is the reporter behind the investigation and joins us. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
You wrote there is this dramatic, mostly unnoticed shift in the control of an important part of this country's housing stock. And you're referring to private investment firms getting into the real estate business. Who are these firms exactly?
Yeah, so these are firms that have private equity backing them. What that means is that these are firms that are financed usually by some of the biggest pots of money on Wall Street, including pension funds, investment banks, college endowments. So huge amounts of money that is invested in these funds, and these funds are created for the purpose of buying large-scale, expensive real estate. And in this case, we're talking about big apartment buildings. millions of dollars, sometimes $1 billion or more. These firms will come in and they'll buy apartments sometimes by the thousands.
You say these kinds of landlords behave in ways that are, you know, adverse to tenants. What are you thinking of?
Well, what we saw was very steep rent increases and also a decline in the services that are being provided to tenants. And that's sort of euphemistic sounding, but what I'm talking about are basic repairs, repairs to appliances, for instance, and maintenance of common areas, security, things that are necessary for people to live comfortable, quality lives, essentially, that those are the types of things that tenants told us were ending up on the chopping block.
What is behind this? You say this is sort of a exploding sort of phenomenon. What's behind this increase in private equity firms getting into the real estate, the landlord business?
Well, what we found was that government-backed financers like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were really fueling this increase in private equity ownership of apartment buildings because they were offering a type of financing that was very attractive to these firms. They had low interest rates and very few conditions on the financing. We obtained some data from Freddie that showed that of the 20 biggest deals that Freddie had ever done in the multifamily sphere, that 85% of them were done with private equity firms. And all of those deals were done since 2015, except for one. So this is really a fairly recent phenomenon that the deals have gotten this big and that private equity has been so dominant.
Ultimately, what do you think the most important implication is here for the experience of, you know, the American renter or homeowner?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is that these companies are acting in ways that are problematic for tenants in order to meet their investment goals. And that while tenants have protections in some cities and in some states, it's really a patchwork across the country. And these are multi-state firms. Sometimes they're global even. And they're coming into these localities. And in some places, there is nothing to protect the tenants. There's talk about trying to add protections into the financing that Freddie and Fannie does. But short of something that has a broader reach across states like that, I'm not sure what people can do.
Heather Vogel, reporter for ProPublica, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.